You're listening to an American Theater podcast. American Theater is published by Theater Communications Group. www.americantheater.org.
Welcome to Off Script, American Theater's podcast on all things theatrical. I'm Rob Wenert, Kent, the editor-in-chief, and I'm here with...
Susie Evans, senior editor.
And...
Russ Denman, managing editor.
And we are here to talk about a few interesting things. One is there's a lot going on in the world and the country, and we thought we would talk a little bit about ways theaters are responding to, what in many ways is a crisis. We will also talk a little bit about another big piece of news not related to that, about the New York Times second string, I guess it might be called, critic, Charles Isherwood, and his fate and what his departure means for the theater, what his tenure meant for the theater. Then we have an interview with Nan Barnett, who's the head of the
executive director of the National New Play Network.
Exactly. Which we've written about a number of times before, but we've never sat down to talk with Nan in depth, at least not for the podcast. And then we'll come back with some recommendations and things to think about and watch and see. So diving right into... So obviously, it's actually, I'll just speak for myself. It's hard to concentrate on work, family, other things with all that's going on in the news cycle. But a few ways in which that has impacted the theater field, or the theater field has responded. There's a story about Robert Schenken, who wrote a play called Building the Wall. I think he said he wrote it in about a week's time.
Yeah, the play is actually a National New Play Network Rolling World premiere.
Is officially that?
Yeah, it is. Okay. So it's being done through NNPN, which is okay. Interesting. So Nan and I talked a bit about that. But yeah, talk more about that.
I first heard about it because I was reporting another story, which you'll see next week, about what's up with the LA 99 seat plan. And the Fountain Theater, which is one of the theaters that's going to adopt the new equity plan with some protest, but that's a whole other controversy. Their first play they're going to do in their season is Building the Wall.
Yeah, they're the first ones to do it in the Rolling World premiere.
And there's a Curious Theater in Colorado. And
yeah, that sounds right. There's a theater in Tucson, I want to say.
Okay.
There's three set, I believe.
Invisible Theater, or is it the Borderlands, or I don't know.
I don't remember, okay. But Nan says it on the interview, so
I will
keep listening.
Keep listening, you'll hear.
Keep listening.
So that's exciting, and that seems to be, from the quick sketch I read, it's set a few years in the future, imagining sort of dystopian...
Yeah, it's set in 2018, I think, right. And it imagines what would happen if the U.S. actually did kind of go after all the illegal immigrants in the country in like a concrete way, and what it would do to the prison system and
right.
Yeah.
And the other thing about Schenken is that he's got two productions of his LBJ Part 2 play, The Great Society, running. Disclosure, I'm dramaturg for one of them. But the fascinating thing about that play is that it really reads differently than it did a couple of years ago when right. It premiered at Seattle Rep and Oregon Shakes. And just a whole host of political and societal issues that have a different resonance.
Well, because Great Society, I have not read the play, but does it, and all the way barely addressed this, or barely hinted in the direction of the ways in which Johnson's foreign policy was a drag on his social program. I mean, the Great Society must deal with that, right? Because Vietnam has just begun, or begun in earnest during All the Way. There's one scene.
Yeah, it's at the heart of the Great Society.
It's at the heart of the Great Society, yeah. I mean, and Voting Rights Act and all the social programs that were brought in the Great Society, obviously still in the news.
Yeah.
and still at issue. Let's see. I just to note one other small thing. Not that small, but Forum Theater in D.C., I think they might have already planned to be doing these plays. One is Monica Burns' What Every Girl Should Know, which is sort of a coming of age tale about girls in the 70s, and birth control is a big topic of it, and Ruby Ray Spiegel's Dry Land, which we've published.
Yep.
They're branding them together, they're running in repertory as hashtag nasty women. And a lot of theaters, of course, as we know, and TCG as well, participate.
I don't know if they came up with that brand.
They did not come up with it.
They're hopping on the hashtag.
they're branding that Samantha Bee, Hillary Clinton convergence there. A number of theaters did participate in the Ghostlight Project. We Facebook Live Facebook lived?
Facebook lived?
No. Facebook lived. We lived it. An event at the Public Theater, which was the night before the inauguration.
It was an event at theaters across the country.
Yeah, all over the country.
We were at the Public.
And it was at 5 p.m., right?
Yeah, maybe 5:30. It was at that time in every time zone. So
you know, and a number of theaters have talked about ways in which their programming either looks different, feels different, or is being changed to reflect.
I mean, is Row at Arena Stage still right now, or did that close?
I don't remember if it's still there, but
it was very recently there. Row, which is about, of course, Roe v. Wade, started at Oregon Shakespeare Festival over the summer, I believe. It had a long run there, and it's either still at Arena or just closed.
The other thing it's worth mentioning, again, this is New York Times reporting. We're not able to do our own reporting on this, to find out if other resident theaters and member theaters around the country were affected by the Muslim majority travel ban. But Waterwell, which is a company based in New York, was going to do a Hamlet, which I believe had a Persian or Iranian element to it, or maybe set there. There was an Iranian American actor whose visa situation meant that he could not come. I actually haven't updated to see if that was because of the extremely broad enforcement of the policy at first, and if he's able to get through now with a stay on it, or if he's not. There was also Sundance. Philip Hinberg, artistic director, their program, which we wrote about last year in our international issue, was focused on Middle East and North Africa. They had already had an emphasis on Africa. And there were some Middle Eastern playwrights in their orbit when they did their workshop, annual workshop here last year. Amazingly, they did their workshop in Morocco, actually in the Middle East North Africa axis there, and I believe it was at least half the artists there were Middle East North Africa, and the rest were, you know, from the U.S. and Europe. And they made a special effort to include refugee and, you know, immigrant artists in that. And I think that the new situation under this president has put that in, you know, stark jeopardy. Again, we should probably do the reporting on the update now that the travel ban seems to have been hit a snag in court, right?
Yeah, it's been blocked by some.
It's been blocked. It's been appealed.
Temporarily.
It leads to a lot of uncertainty. And, you know, it should be emphasized that the uncertainty is its own kind of wrong or evil that's being done to people. So I don't know if there's anybody else has seen anything else or you know, taking the pulse of where theater folks are in relation to all this that's going on.
I mean, I think theater folks want to help and do things to create change. So
yeah.
They're looking for ways to get shows and get things up quickly. I mean, with Building the Wall, Robert Jenkins' piece, he wrote that play in a week and already had it at... So, like, people are mobilizing fast from what I can see on Facebook, at least.
Yeah.
I noticed that... this is a quote I wasn't able to source, and I think it probably passed my Twitter feed quickly, but someone said that they were trying to find the provenance, or maybe it was just a made-up quote, that in hard times, you turn to Brecht like the Bible, or something like that. And I've heard people, you know, since the election results, people reading a lot of Brecht. Haven't seen a ton of Brecht on the calendars. I know that there's a company here in New York, whose name escapes me, that is doing the resistible, that already did the Resistible Rise of Arturo Wee, which is Brecht's sort of like thinly veiled piece about Hitler.
Did someone do Uber Wah too? I think they did.
Uber Wah, maybe. Jerry's piece. I think even people talking about Julius Caesar is a play which is on a lot of calendars and never very far from relevance. Or Coriolanus, those plays about the Roman Empire and the prerogatives of the emperor versus the republic and the democracy. You know, freshly relevant in every possible way. And of course, we know that the first show announced for the new Broadway season.
1984.
Yes, that new bestseller, that hit bestseller.
And I heard a rumor it's a bestseller for TCG Books, too.
Yeah, Oberon, which we distribute.
Right.
Is a publisher of that British. And you know, it's funny, I looked it up. We wrote about that headlong production of 1984 about 3 or 4 years ago because Headlong was part of a gender parity initiative, and we just happened to be the production that they were profiling was 1984. So it's been around a while, this version. I know Tim Robbins' Actors Gang had a version of it.
This version has never been on Broadway, though.
No. It's never been in the States, as far as I know. I don't think, unless it's toured a bit. Yeah, exciting times. We'll keep our eye on ways that the theaters responded to it. And I think I've repeated this vow on this podcast a few times already, which I still haven't done, which is this magazine was founded in 1984, in the midst of the Reagan-Bush years. And I am eager to look back again at how theaters responded to those times and how American theater covered it. Covered the theater's response to the AIDS crisis, to Iran-Contra, to, you know, let's not say the dismantling of the social safety net, but the attacks on that. And I think it would be and the cult of personality also of that political time, and how that plays now. I remember I'll just close with this thought. I remember seeing Angels in America, which was interestingly written during the late Bush years and first staged during the Clinton years. I remember seeing it, gosh, how long ago was this? During the George W. Bush years, a revival. There's a remarkable scene you might remember from the beginning when Joe Pitt is talking to a Republican operative, sort of a Karl Rove type person, talking about a permanent Republican majority that's within sight. And that felt at the time, even in the Bush years, like, well, is that really the case? You know, even the Bush years, because there was there was some division then. That scene, like, which was played differently in the Clinton years, certainly, it's going to play a little differently now. I just remember that being a particular reflection on its time. Sort of, like, prescient is not the right word for a play as old as that, but maybe relevant is the word. You know, I think one definition of a classic is a play that's always relevant. But in any case, there's no easy way to segue to the next topic, which is New York Times critic who started in 2004, Charles Isherwood, as of this past week, has departed the Times. We wrote a story about it. The rumors were flying for a little bit over the weekend, and it was confirmed yesterday, I guess yesterday. That's when we ran the story, as of this taping, Tuesday. I think Charles Isherwood loomed large in the minds of many in the theater, even though he was technically the second string critic, and Ben Brantley is the one who covers the bigger Broadway openings. Isherwood's influence was pretty large as well.
He still covered Broadway, and
oh yeah,
oh he did,
and he covered a lot of shows out of town that then came to Broadway, which was a lot of his influence.
Yeah, August Osage County
and out of town productions.
That's true. I mean, the way that the second string thing worked out, I think it's not state secrets to say that basically the first critic, Ben Brantley, had the pick of what he wanted to cover, and he was expected to cover most of the big Broadway openings. Although you'll notice that he has a real affinity for some downtown artists. And
yeah, but for example, if Charles had reviewed, you know, Hands on a Hard Body in California, and then it comes to Broadway, he usually would do it when it would come to Broadway.
That was usually their policy, yeah.
Usually.
Yeah, so he wasn't indeed influential with... He was the critic who went to the Humana Festival, for instance, and often to Chicago, Los Angeles, which is where he sort of started reviewing.
And OSF.
And Organ Shakes, yeah. He was sort of a... it's always gratifying to me when the critics discover the joys of Organ Shakes.
Sure.
And so he became a fan of that, clearly. You know, it has to be said that he... had very strong tastes as a press person once put it to me, and they actually liked his writing, but they felt like his strong tastes were an odd fit for someone who had to see so much different stuff and have such influence. I mean, there's another way to say it was he was very divisive and polarizing.
Well, he was championing young writers and was reviewing new work, which can. You know, when you're reviewing people early in their careers.
He was championing some, like Sarah Ruhl and Lil Eno and others. You know, I think the rap on him was that he was overly dismissive and withering about productions and writers who, you know, were not necessarily fully formed. I mean, I think my version of that critique would be that sometimes it felt as if he was writing from a point of view of like, impress me, what have you got? And sometimes given the weight of a Times review. Mm-hmm. I mean, I reviewed for a while for the New York Times and for the LA Times, and I always felt like that was such a huge sledgehammer that even the slightest bit of faint praise would be like a huge hammer on people. And you know, sure, that didn't make me hold back too much, but I kept it in mind. I feel like there was almost a glee in with which he wielded that hammer. And sometimes I think, to be frank, with good cause. I like a critic who will talk straight and not, you know, pull punches. I'm also of the mind that when he was at Variety, when he was the lead critic there, his reviews were lively, and he was often taking down, you know, the Goliaths, you know, the big Broadway shows that deserved a knock. And sometimes it felt like, again, this is overgeneralizing because he championed a lot of tiny work and a lot of artists who, you know, would not have a career without his advocacy. But it felt sometimes like his Olympian sneer, if you will, was disproportionate to the size of the people he was taking on. You know, every artist who's criticized by any critic is going to feel this, you know, feel like it's unfair. But
I don't know. I mean, I feel like any critic is kind of divisive, and I feel like his work feels the most divisive to us because he reviews most of the stuff that falls under American Theater's purview.
Yeah, that's true. Nonprofit and off-Broadway. And
true.
Yeah, it's true. I mean, we might be disproportionately exposed to people who don't like his work, especially in the new play world. I will say, it's interesting, I feel like his sort of attitude about theater, and it was very much an attitude, I think we maybe underestimate how much that might have been popular with readers. That like it did reflect an actual point of view, and people appreciated someone who would just sort of,
I mean, he's writing like for readers and not for theater
people necessarily.
Of course,
exactly. I mean, apart from the fact that there are a lot of very interested readers who just don't like critics because at all, A, or B, because they just don't agree with them and they think that that's the only way to evaluate a critic. I mean, yes, a critic's taste and whether you agree with them or not is really important, but I mean, I read critics for their insights and their making me think about things that I didn't think about.
I mean, I grew up reading critics. That's how I knew about this. I wanted to know about the show. I followed people whose opinions I liked and who had a funny tone and a good voice and who could put it in context, and I feel like that was something that he did. And, you know, the artists will sometimes quabble about that, but, you know, as a reader, it was entertaining.
And that's one of the tricky things about the role of the critic in general, which probably goes without saying, that they need to take a strong stand and they need to have a very prominent voice, and so it lends itself to being divisive. So it's a really difficult balance to achieve.
I mean, a critic is never going to make everyone happy.
Right.
No, and it shouldn't. No, look, I think the role of the critic is to be the role of the critic, I've always often said, and I think I put it this way in that Matt Winman book, is like the critic is part of the theater community. I really do believe that. But they're the person who comes to the party and tells people just like, you know, that dress looks terrible on you. Like something stinks here. What is that? What is that hors d'oeuvre? You know, like that's a really annoying person. But you need that person. You're the person who will basically, whose only duty is to tell the truth as he sees it or she sees it. Fintan O'Toole wrote my favorite piece. I think I've posted it many times on online for The Economist many years ago about what a critic's role is. I'm going to misquote it, but is just to be true to themselves and to bring their full subjectivity to it. It's not to stand on high or to render an objective judgment or be just a reporter, but to bring their full selves and their full sensibility to the work they do. And I think at their best, you know, the critics that we read do that. And I think at his best, Charles did. I will say also, just on a personal note, Charles, I was friendly with him. We weren't close friends, but we had lunch over the years. He helped open the door for me when I came to New York. I've never to this day figured out whether he, you know, went to bat really, or just said, "Oh, here's this guy," and forwarded my email to the editors. But I consider it a crucial step for me. And you know, the cheering on social media that I'm seeing from some quarters, although I completely understand it,
it's upsetting.
Yeah,
it bums me out. Yeah, it bums me out. And again, I completely get it, and I even share some of the specific criticisms. I don't share the sort of glee that people have. I think at first I was really sick about it because I felt like, oh, this could be part of the of plan to decrease coverage. It turns out the Times is planning to fill the position. They put out a job description, which reads very aspirationally and idealistically. Yeah. It sounds great.
It's a well written job description.
It is. If someone can do all the things they want them to do, distressing, especially discovery and different regions, and a lot of the things which I think were clearly what they wanted Charles to do, and which I think is best. He did. He did discover new talent. He did cover theater all over. He showed a certain excitement for it. Occasionally, he didn't show so much excitement for the work he saw, which, again, your mileage will vary whether that was justified or not. You know, it's funny. I was just to play devil's advocate with some of the folks who are in the new play world. I won't name any names, who are found that he was a scourge to new playwrights, or like thought he was like the wrong guy to be reviewing them. And again, occasionally I would agree with that criticism. We just read this big piece by Helen Shaw, and there's like this consensus that we're in a golden age of playwriting. Now, they're not. I'm not saying he's responsible for that, or that critics have. But critics do have a role to play in what plays are being made and what plays are being exalted. Maybe we may be taking for granted, you know, a resource there.
And I think theater people need to acknowledge better the role of the critic and the value of the critic.
Right. Yes. I mean, I think it's fair. Criticism needs to be turned on itself sometimes, and critics need to look at whether they're living up to their role, and need to be self-critical and constantly reevaluating their role.
But artists need to be turned on themselves, right?
Well,
sometimes.
Yeah, exactly. No. I'm thinking out loud here for a story that needs to be written, no matter what happens with this position, no matter who takes the role, making the case for what critics do for theater ecology, what they do to help nurture nurturing good theater does not mean praising everyone. Right. Does not mean saying nice things to every new playwright that comes along.
Every bad review can't be, "Well, they tried."
Well,
right.
Of course. Yeah, exactly. So. Yeah, it's obviously something that's dear to my heart. Just the case for criticism, and independent criticism, and good and responsible criticism too. Cultural competency is a word I hear a lot, and I think that's a useful phrase for criticism that has to deal with a field that's changed and diversified. And I've said this before a lot. I feel like the theater world has diversified a lot more than the criticism that covers it. But I think, you know, I think there's an opportunity to change that. And I think hopefully we'll see that in the future. And we can play a part of that, and the Times will as well. I don't want to hog the discussion if anyone has anything else to say. I could talk all night.
I mean, I think we're good.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So speaking of new plays, there's a segue. Here's our interview with Nan Barnett.
Nan Barnett, Executive Director of the National New Play Network. Enjoy. There. Okay. Now we just pretend this is a man. Well, welcome, Nan. We are here with Nan Barnett, who is the executive director of the National New Play Network, on one of her many visits to New York. We were just talking yesterday. You travel a lot for your job, yeah?
I do. I still love it. I keep thinking I'll get tired of it, but not yet. It's pretty great. I pretty much travel every week, especially, you know, different times of the year. This week, I have been in Miami, Philadelphia, and New York, and I have had meetings with probably 8 or 9 people in 2 days here in New York.
Oh, my gosh. So you must be a packing expert.
I am a packing expert, but I keep doing this thing where I make myself go from Miami to New York. So I have flip-flops and boots in my bag. I want to start traveling only on specific parallels, and then maybe I can keep up with the weather. But, yeah, I'm pretty good at it. I can do 3 or 4 days in a small bag, and as long as I don't have to carry things. I have a big computer, though. I should fix that.
Yeah, you should get heavy. Like an Air or something.
Yeah, something, yeah.
Cool. Well, we're really excited to talk to you because the National New Play Network obviously is a huge champion of new plays mm-hmm. and does the Rolling World premieres. And I guess for some of our listeners, can you just give a little brief summary of what the National New Play Network does? Because it feels like it has a lot of services that people
sure,
don't
absolutely.
Know beyond the yeah. Rolling World premieres.
So we are an alliance of more than 100 professional not-for-profit theaters all across the United States that have a focus on new works. And it's the development, production, and continued life, as well as a mandate to innovate and implement new ways of communication for the field between theaters and theater makers. So we do, in addition to the Rolling World premieres, and we can talk a little more about what
yeah,
those
definitely.
Are and how they work, we offer commissions, residencies, we have several funding programs, but all through the theaters. It gets confusing because we have a ton of benefits for playwrights, but they have to come to us with a project through one of our theaters. There are 30 core member theaters. Those are theaters that have committed to actually being a part of the governance of the organization and the planning for that implementation and innovation. And they are also companies that have new works at the heart of their mission. Our associate members tend to be theaters that are either small and wanting to have access to new works, or much bigger theaters where they have a new play arm or a festival or a development piece of what they do. So the companies range in size from about $50,000 a year annually up through Oregon Shakes and South Coast Rep and Denver Center. So it's a really wide variety. We're in 70 cities
wow.
across the country.
Are you in every state yet?
We are not. We're in, I think it's 40.
Okay.
I really want to Hawaii.
Okay. Are you out there, Hawaii?
I want to do site visits. If Hawaii, if you're listening and you do new work, get in touch with me.
I feel like there are great theaters in Hawaii that do new work.
Oh, there absolutely are. We don't generally recruit. It's about people coming to us because they want to be a part of one of the programs, because they want to have access to what we're doing. And it's been a lot of growth in the last few years.
Yeah. How long have you been with the organization?
I was I was a Lort managing director and was a part of the organization, the company that I ran. And then I sat on the executive committee for 6 years in the mid-2000s and was president for a while. And then in 2013, I came to the organization as the executive director.
Oh, great. And how many Rolling World premieres do you do at one time? And can you talk a little bit about what a
sure.
Rolling World premiere is?
So, yeah, a Rolling World premiere happens when 3 or more artistic directors...
Get a little closer to the microphone.
A Rolling World premiere happens when 3 or more artistic directors agree to work with a playwright on a previously unproduced play, and within 12 months produce entirely separate and distinct productions with the playwright in residence and continuing to develop the work. So you might, for example, have a Rolling World premiere that begins in a 49-seat house in storefront in Chicago, and then it's in a 250-seat Lort Theater in California, and then it's in a 99-seat space in Portland, Oregon, and then it finishes up in a major performing arts center in Miami. So a playwright gets the opportunity to see the play in the hands of different actors, directors, designers in what are awfully vastly different spaces, And in a great array of communities, we find that, you know, how something plays in Skokie is not maybe how it's going to play in Iowa City, or in, I don't know, Seattle can be very different from San Francisco. Mm-hmm. So it's been just an amazing program. It's about 15 years old now, and I believe that the program, the shows that we're going to contract with this week, which there are a couple of, will take us over 70 of them.
Wow.
The big thing about them is not only does the playwright get the chance to develop the play, but the work that we do as an NPN staff, providing support for the collaboration between the different organizations, providing billing negotiations so that the play has a billing in perpetuity, listing the multiple theaters that were a part of the Rolling World premiere, as well as individual sponsors when that happens. We handle all of that kind of thing, but we also do multiple press releases and make sure that the play, as it's moving across the country, is ginning up enough interest so that when the roll is finished and those three or five or seven theaters have done it within that 12-month period, that then the play goes on to subsequent productions.
Mm-hmm.
So we have, you know, plays that have seen, you know, 10 or 12 or 15 productions in the next few years, which is really great. But we also have plays that have had 40 and 60 and 80 productions in their subsequent life. Often the playwrights that are working with NNPN are people who have a home base and a career outside of New York.
Mm-hmm.
And this just gives them a chance to be seen all across the country.
Yeah.
So they can be emerging playwrights. They can be mid-career playwrights. And then we also have some major folks who work with us because they love the idea of being able to develop the script outside of the city.
Yeah.
And without that sort of intense scrutiny. And also that, you know, their plays speak to the community larger mm-hmm. than what's in Manhattan. And so we have the great opportunity to work with playwrights at all different points of their careers. And they have the opportunity to work in theaters of all shapes and sizes.
Yeah, and I want to get back to that because I know you're working with a very established playwright right now on a very topical play that's interesting. And we're definitely going to discuss it. But I want to ask a little bit about, so the projects come to you through the theater. So theater mm-hmm. brings you. Do all the theaters come together and say, we want to do the rolling premiere, the three of us? Or mm-hmm. do you help kind of find other partners?
We do. We generally help brokers. So there's a monthly alert that goes out. So when a theater is starting to think about a play, or they believe that there's a play that other companies in the network would be interested in, they let us know. We take all the information. And then once a month, a document goes out that says, here are the plays that are being brought forward for people to read. Here are the plays that are starting to develop partnerships and are looking for additional partners. And then ultimately, once they're contracted, we do one more round before it begins rehearsal, because everybody has to commit before that first day of the first rehearsal for the first production. And we'll do one more round saying, this one's about to begin. Does anybody else want to dive on? And we do. Sometimes that happens where a season has changed or people are looking for one more show or something becomes very topical.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes people will come on very late at the end. Sometimes it can take a couple of years to get a role together. Sometimes they happen sort of instantaneously.
Yeah, I was going to say, it must be a scheduling nightmare trying to figure out the dates for every theater.
You know, because what we do is put the projects together, and of course, whenever there's an agent, the agent and the playwright ultimately hold the rights to the play, and they determine what order they'd like to see them go in.
Mm-hmm.
Rarely do we lose a project because dates won't work. Sometimes it means that a playwright will have two productions in rehearsal at the same time. Mm-hmm. I know last year we had a playwright that was flying back and forth between Kansas City and Tucson over a couple of weeks as they were getting ready to open, because they were opening, you know, within the weekend of each other. And then sometimes you get one and that's the beginning of the role, and it might be 6 or 8 months before the second one happens. Mm. A lot of times it depends on the playwright's schedule as well as the theaters, of course.
Yeah. And I mean, how many do you have going on at one time?
Generally, because they can actually span a couple of years from the time they get started, and we begin talking about it before the first production goes into rehearsal, and then there's 12 months after that. But at any one time, we might have 7 to 12 projects happening that are in the, you know, live box. And there's always an additional 5 to 10 that are out there that we're working on trying to get the second or third partner on. So it's a pretty fluid and lively program for
us. And have you ever worked with the same playwright more than once on a world premiere?
Yeah, there are several. Thomas Gibbons, who was the playwright who wrote what was the pilot for this program, has now had several. Steve Yockey, a wonderful California-based writer, he actually had two plays in the same season.
Yeah, I think we wrote an article about that.
Yeah, and he had one of his plays that got 7 productions in 12 months as a part of the official role.
Wow.
And then another one at the same time that was getting 3. Stephen Dietz has had multiple ones with us. Sean Lewis. You know, so many of our programs, because we also offer things, you know, for beginning while people are in their MFAs all the way through. So I actually really love it when those programs begin to intersect and overlap. So Sean Lewis is a wonderful writer who came to us through our MFA program that we do with the Kennedy Center and the American College Theater Festival. He then, while there, met an artistic director, and together they applied for a residency. Sean went and did a residency. He's had commissions through us. He's been in our national showcase. He's had rolling world premieres. And he's now serving as the interim artistic director of one of our core member theaters.
Oh, wow.
Which I just, that's sort of completely full circle. Sean has a play that's getting a rolling world premiere this year as well. And it's, I don't know if it's his third, maybe, that's happened. So, yeah, we love to work with writers repeatedly, but we also love bringing new people into the fold. Again, both early career writers and more established writers.
Totally, yeah. And I mean, it's interesting you mentioned this kind of at the beginning of our conversation about how it's mostly writers whose home base is outside of New York.
Mm-hmm.
And it's mostly, I mean, you have core member theaters in New York, right?
Actually, we don't.
You don't? Okay.
We don't.
Wow.
For the longest time, you couldn't be a member if you were in New York.
Interesting.
It was part of the original concept of the organization was that we wanted to make sure that people were aware that theater could come to the city as opposed to having to go from the city.
Exactly. I was just going to ask about that.
Yeah. So there are no core members in New York. There are a few associates now. But again, because we don't really recruit, it's not been a big focus for us.
Yeah. And so can you talk a little bit more about that idea of like playwright being seen across the country? Because there's so much idea that the new play pipeline is like it has to show at New York Theater Workshop or the Public, both excellent theaters.
Right.
And then moves to the country. And it's kind of the opposite. Like the example I'm thinking of is Lauren Gunderson's I and You.
Right.
Which we had published and had a ton in the Rolling World premiere.
Yeah. So it had a Rolling World premiere with 3 or 4 companies. And then went on, and by the time it came to the city, it was the 20th production.
Mm-hmm.
And that is kind of perfect, I think, for a writer to have the time to polish and know what they want their piece to be, and then to be able to share it with New York. But because of the work that we do, and the writer and their agent, of course, she could have 20 productions without having to have the seal of approval from a New York theater.
Yeah.
And I think that's really important. I know Deborah Zoloffer is a playwright who came to us. She had a Rolling World premiere with her second production, which was a play called End Days. And that is a play that, I mean, she's been in 60-plus theaters now, including several international productions. Deb was a playwright that was unknown in New York or the regions at the time, and was this quirky little odd play, post 9/11 play, with a young character who dresses like Elvis and a goth child and an actor who doubles as both Jesus Christ and Stephen Hawking. You know, quirky little play, but it spoke so beautifully to relationships and religion and science and how they intersect, and was funny and touching and wonderful. And because we were able to lift the play up in a way that people became aware of it, and it started getting produced and produced and produced and produced. And those are the real success stories for us. I mean, we're obviously, there are wonderful organizations across the country that are doing new play development. There are plenty of theaters that are producing new work now, thankfully, mm-hmm. both inside and outside of the membership. But the continued life piece of it is something that we're the only organization that's really doing.
Yeah.
And to be able to embrace the whole arc of the play. And then now, of course, we're also doing really development of people's careers. We're doing development of organizations, helping those associate members move up and grow and get greater access to writers to help build their board's confidence in what it is to do new work, to help get their audiences really excited about being a part of the creation of something new. We feel really strongly that the infrastructure system that we've been able to support is really changing how theater gets made and shared. And then, of course, with the advent of the New Play Exchange, that's just a whole other level of really wonderful ways of getting new works into the hands of people that want to do them but wouldn't normally have had access.
Yeah. And what is the New Play Exchange?
The New Play Exchange is a database of works by living writers. It began about 4 years ago as an idea. We actually launched it in January of 15. So we've just had our second birthday. It now has more than 11,000 plays on it and more than 9,000 users. So the way it works is there are three platforms, one for playwrights, one for organizations, and one for, quote, readers, unquote. So people, anybody that's looking to read a play, find a play, learn anything about a playwright. It has a very low entry point. It's $10 a year. A playwright goes on and creates a profile that includes their bio and their photo if they'd like, or an image of what they'd like to represent them, an artistic statement. And then they begin to upload their work. And by uploading their work, you can do just a synopsis, a sample, or your full play. And then you tag that work with keywords and metadata so that things are, you know, simple things like genre of the play and the cast size and the gender and ethnicity of the actors needed. And then the keywords are topics. So it might be girl power and assassination, or it might be, politics, or it might be love or relationships.
Are these predetermined topics, or you can come up with your own?
You can come up with your own, but there is a pull-down menu, so when you start to type, you can see what people have been using for search keywords. Mm-hmm. And then as a playwright, that's all you have to do. You've just now shared your work with 9,000 people.
Mm-hmm.
As a reader, you can go on, you can look up for free, you can look up a play by playwright's name or title and find out the playwright's contact information and the history of the play, where it's been done, the synopsis and all of that. But for also $10 a year, you have access to a search mechanism that kind of works like Kayak.
Mm-hmm.
So if you want to, you want to read a new play by a woman who's living in Iowa, you can do that. But if you want to read a new play by a woman who's living in Iowa, and that play has never been produced and it has four actors, all under 60, two of whom are African-American males. You can narrow it down in that way, so you can get to exactly the play that speaks to you, exactly the play you're looking for if you're a producer. It's really kind of astounding, the things you can do.
And have premieres happened through this? Just people finding plays through this?
Yes.
That are not Rolling World premieres?
They're not Rolling World premieres. We are hearing from people pretty much every day now saying, I just got a call from a theater in Detroit I had never heard of, and they want to read my play. I'm getting a reading of my play at a theater in Florida, and I live in Seattle. Who knew? I'm getting a production of my play. And one of the new features on it is what we call an opportunity module, where a theater is allowed to go in and create an opportunity. And if you have a play in the system that matches that opportunity, say people wanting to read, you know, 20-minute or under plays about LGBTQ issues, mm-hmm. they post that. And if you have a play that matches that, you get an activity notice that says, your play is eligible for this opportunity. Would you like to submit, yes or no? You press the button, and it's gone.
Oh, wow.
It goes right to them. So we are about to have our first play that we hope is going to be a Rolling World premiere, but it's getting its world premiere in Texas at Kitchen Dog Theater, and it is a play that was submitted blind through the opportunity module. They chose it for their festival. They did a reading of it. They submitted it for our national showcase. It had a reading there, and they are going to do a world premiere of it this spring. Mm-hmm. So it's our first one to bring all of our programs in together. But yeah, people are getting productions. And you also have things like a private library. You have the ability to make recommendations. You have the ability to watch, which I know is kind of weird, but it follow was taken.
Yeah.
So we say you watch. You can watch playwrights specifically. You can watch organizations so that if you're following me, say, or sorry, watching me, whenever I make a new recommendation, you get a notice that says, Nan just recommended this new play. Would you like to see it?
Yeah.
And then you click on it, and if you don't want to read it right then, you move it to your private library. It sits there until you're ready to read it and look at it and make a recommendation yourself. It's truly changing how plays are shared, discovered, and ultimately produced around the world. We have users from 44 countries right now, and we've yet to market it. That's the brilliant thing. That's the thing that I love. The industry was just so hungry for it. We're finding huge successes with the universities and colleges. Mm-hmm. They really want to do new work, and previously there was no real way of accessing it. You had to wait till it was published by Samuel French and, you know, be able to go into the catalog and look it up. Mm-hmm. And then you kind of had to know what you were looking for in order to find it. Now you can, you know, create a search that says, I want to see any plays with 10 women under 30 in it. Mm-hmm. And you can even save that search. So whenever a new play that matches that criteria comes up, you get a notice saying, hey, there's a new play that you might want to look at.
Wow. That's awesome.
It's pretty revolutionary.
Yeah.
We're excited about it, and we're really thrilled that it's been, has taken off so quickly and that people are finding it so useful.
Yeah. Well, that's fascinating. And now I want to kind of take a U-turn.
Great.
And talk about what we kind of mentioned before, which is a Rolling World premiere you're working on right now, which is a little bit unconventional with an established playwright. You're doing Robert Schenken's Building the Wall, which he wrote very recently, extremely topical, and is launching its world premiere at
Fountain Theater in Los Angeles.
I was going to say a different theater. So,
It came together really quickly because he wrote it right around the election, and he wrote it in a week. And
wow.
Of course, if you know Mr. Schenken's work, he's Kentucky Cycle, you know, all the way, things that normally he's a great researcher and digger and developer, and he felt really strongly about what was happening in the country. And
He's also a playwright that could open cold in New York.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
Right. So he came to us and said that he had this play. He felt really strongly that he wanted it to be done by as many theaters as possible around the country as quickly as possible. Mm-hmm. And they knew that the Rolling World Premiere mechanism was a great way of being able to get it out there. We were able to... so, of course, many of our core member theaters know his work and have done his work. We started talking with a couple of people, and it has really in... let's see, he wrote it right before the election. I started chatting with them in December, early December, and we went to contract, and the New York Times broke it on Monday mm-hmm. that it's going to happen. There are at least four, potentially maybe as many as six or seven NNPN theaters that will be a part of the role. Mm-hmm. It's right now we are have contracts with Fountain in LA, Curious in Denver, Borderlands in Tucson, and Forum Theater Company in Silver Spring, Maryland, which is basically DC. Mm-hmm. So that's three core members plus one associate. I know there's at least two other associates that we're still having conversations with. It's very hard hitting. It's a two-hander. One set and one, you know, long act, and it is gonna shake some people in their shoes. I think I love the fact that NNPN's programs and members are nimble enough to be able to react in this way to something that obviously, you know, so many people feel so strongly about. Mm-hmm. And we have a lot of other theaters that are producing work that speaks to what's going on right now. I just saw a wonderful, wonderful world premiere of a new play called Marcus/Emma at Interact about Marcus Garvey and Emma Goldman.
Oh, wow.
There are, you know, a couple of other plays that people are finding both old and new, you know, looking back at pieces from the 30s and the 50s and other times of crisis within our country, and wanting to provide a forum for audiences to be able to think about what they feel might happen, what their fears are, what their hopes are, and to have a theater be a place where they can talk about those things.
Yeah.
And NPN only holds exclusive rights to the first production. So even though the Rolling World premiere is going to take 12 months to complete and go across the country, a playwright can continue to license the play after the first one opens.
Okay.
So you might get five official NNPN Rolling World premiere productions, but you might also get five additional productions. George Brandt's Grounded is a great example of that. That was a play that won our Smith Prize, and we helped develop it. It had a Rolling World premiere, and of course, before the 12th production, before the 12 months was up, he had had, you know, productions in Edinburgh and London and all over the country, and we were delighted to see that happen. We don't try to clamp down on it. We don't even hold actually a patent on the term Rolling World premiere, and have been encouraging other people to use it anytime you're doing this sort of co-development. Remember, it's not a tour. Mm-hmm. It's not a co-production.
Yeah, no.
But being developed with multiple theaters. Actually,
it's not the same cast, same director.
Right. It in fact, within the Rolling World premiere, if you want to use the same anything, you actually have to get special dispensation to
do
it. We let it happen every now and then, you know, if a like a sound design that's really integral to the storytelling of the piece, mm-hmm. you know, if there's somebody that wants to use that sort of thing. We occasionally have allowed a director to direct multiple productions. When we were working on Colossal, mm-hmm. Andrew Hindenraker's play about... it's a play that he wrote to a prompt to write an unproducible play mm-hmm. While he was still in his MFA.
Wow.
It was done at our MFA workshop. It requires a marching band, a drum line, a football team, a modern dance company, and a paralyzed actor.
Wow.
And he had four productions in a Rolling World premiere and has had some subsequent productions. Because our folks love a challenge.
Yeah. But Michael Patrick Thornton, who was in that, he did right. multiple productions, right?
He actually.
Or did he only do one?
He only did one.
Oh, interesting.
But we did allow Will Davis.
But Will Davis directed
more
than one.
Who directed it. Because we had two productions. The first two productions were back to back at Olney and at Mixed Blood in Minneapolis, okay. Olney in Maryland. And because of the sort of inherent danger involved in the play, mm-hmm. Andrew and Will and the artistic directors in those productions felt there wasn't going to be enough time to process what got learned in the first production.
Yeah.
To be able to pass it on. So Will actually directed, but again, two entirely different casts, different designers, very different spaces.
For some reason, I thought Michael had done both of those.
No, Michael only did the one. Michael did the early development okay. of the piece, had worked with Andrew. He did the MFA production okay. or the workshop that we did.
Well, I feel like I've exhausted you with all of my questions. Did I miss something or did something else we should chat about?
I say I have the best job in American theater, and I'm so happy to be a part of it and to have this great gift of being able to help others get their work out there, get it to be seen by as many people as possible, and to be able to help, you know, create careers and make new theater possible for everybody in the States.
Yeah. Well, you definitely see more theater across the country than probably anyone else in the American theater.
I love it. It's great.
Yeah, cool. Well, thank you so much for stopping by, Nan. This has been really fun to pick your brain, and I'm sure we'll hear from you again soon.
Great.
Can't escape the National New Play Network. It's yep, everywhere.
We're everywhere. Thank you.
Thanks so much. I really hope we haven't already recommended this. I don't remember us recommending it, but I'm going to be lazy because I honestly have not been to the theater in a while. But I am going to recommend Jitney on Broadway.
I think we talked about it, but I don't know if we recommended it.
I feel like we talked about it, but I don't feel like it was an official recommendation.
Okay.
It's the last thing I saw. It was really great.
We talked about how I would recommend it, even though I didn't think it was as great as you thought it was.
I thought it was great. I thought it was really slow in the beginning.
Yeah, yeah.
But, I mean, I would pay all the monies to see John Douglas Thompson and Brandon Dearden do that scene over and over and over again. It was just like a masterclass of August Wilson monologues by masters, and I just thought it's worth seeing. So I'm going to say Jitney.
He's always worth seeing. It's not his best play, but as we talked about before, I think Brandon Dearden's miscast, but he's great even when miscast is all I would say.
He's not miscast. He's wonderful.
And did we say that it's at Manhattan
it's
Theater
on Broadway
Club?
At the Manhattan,
Manhattan
Theater
Club.
Club
through whenever
it's sometime. A limited run because Little Fox
I will say
comes in.
It's a play that deserves to be done. I saw production many years ago at the Mark Tabor Forum. I think it's second tier Wilson, but that's still pretty great. And once you've done, you know, Seven Guitars and Piano Lesson and Joe Turner and Fences, then you do this one. That's my recommendation.
It's got some great scenes.
Wow. Do it. Russ, what do you have there?
I have another New York recommendation. This is Atlantic Theater Company with the world premiere of Tell Hector I Miss Him, which is running through the 19th. It's a great ensemble piece set in old San Juan and a lot of great performances. Actually, two cast members are on Orange is the New Black. Okay. But it's just, it's great because it's a lot of everyday problems that get elevated when they're all together and there are light moments, and it's just a really good piece.
And the playwright is?
Paolo Lazzaro.
Okay, and is it a period piece or it's set in contemporary San Juan?
I believe it's contemporary.
Oh, contemporary, okay. Cool. That was sort of on my radar. I should check that out. My recommendation is not particularly adventuresome one. It's also August Wilson. I finally saw Fences, the movie.
Good choice.
Which as with La La Land, I will say it's been a little overrated.
Oh man, I had a movie I could have recommended.
But
I do
think just the chance to see August Wilson's Pittsburgh rendered on screen was just. I, you know, it's hard to put into words how that, how sort of just moving that is on its own. I do think the scene, it blown up to the big screen, done very faithfully to the play, sort of points up, you know, some of the bagginess of the writing. It's like an Arthur Miller play. It kind of circles the same themes a little bit, pounds them home a little much. And also the lyrical language is like great to hear. It's not always, doesn't always feel like we're watching a movie as much as a stage play, and, but that's fine. Yeah. That's a criticism. But I think the analogy I've made, and I wrote a review for America Magazine, it's as if Tennessee Williams punched up the dialogue in an Arthur Miller play. So it's like you've got the flowery language and the sort of like overdetermined dramaturgy, and it sort of feels a little bit much, but it's so, it's a little broody and prestige-y, but you know, to see Stephen McKinley Henderson, I think the supporting players, yeah, the leads are great, but the supporting players especially really hit home. Russell Hornsby as the older brother.
It's almost the exact same cast as the Broadway almost, production, yeah, except for the son.
Yes. I think the other son, Russell Hornsby was on Broadway too?
I'm not sure.
I know Michael T. Williamson was, and he's much more effective on the screen than he was on stage, I think. Something about the way that they use reaction shots is something that's really interesting. I've always noticed when you adapt a play and you have shots of people like laughing or listening or contemplating with it, that is, there such an art to doing that right? And I don't think Denzel totally masters all of it, but it's just it brings up, it just makes the play feel more resonant in a way that's already very resonant. It's not opened up very much in terms of the staging, but in terms of this sort of way that the characters interrelate, he could have almost gone further. But anyway, it's if you like August Wilson and you want to see more films be made of his work.
Isn't Denzel doing the whole Century Cycle? That's what I heard.
I thought that was HBO was doing it.
Yeah, HBO Films. But I think Denzel's directing all of them.
But see, The Fences is not part of that, though, from
it
what
isn't?
I understand. Yeah, I think they're sort of separate, but hey, whoever can do it, he's good. He's good at it. He's good.
I don't think Denzel's going to be in.
I would
all
love
of them.
To see other directors take it on too. You know, other great filmmakers. And you know, I wouldn't mind a little more adaptation in the work. I think I could stand it.
I think August Wilson actually wrote the screenplay.
No, no. Yeah. I know. It would have been. Yeah. It. Look, these are all quibbles. It's you know, it's a work of a master rendered for a different medium, and it's wonderful. So definitely see that, and I think that's it. I think, you know, go to our iTunes page and rate us. That helps people find our show. At least that's what other podcasts say.
Everything we've talked about will be on the show notes.
Exactly.
Yep.
So until next time, enjoy.
See you at the theater.